Welcome to Target Cancer Podcast. My name is Dr. Sanjay Juneja. I'm a hematologist, medical oncologist, also known as the Onc Doc on news and social media. And you have been listening, hopefully, to Target Cancer Podcast because you want to know how are we somewhat behind? Why are the statistics, you know, you have a 40% chance of responding or 60%? And it's like all of the things that we know and have identified and talked about sequencing and molecular and escape pathways, we still use these definitions. And if you've listened to episodes before, you've heard me kind of almost complain of sorts to say, I still have to give these general continents of expectation and the regimens don't change based on the color of my skin or treatments I've had. They're just very identified algorithms that we've been using for a long time based on really a macro, you know, scopic, meaning like you're looking at the tumor type, where it originated and kind of proceeding from there. If you have appreciated that frustration, this episode, I think, is going to be a real treat because here we will be talking, and I'm going to let the story behind it all, you know, be shared organically. But we're going to talk about just that. We know that tumors evolve. We know that the tumor you biopsied, if it disappeared with your first line and you have spots that come up elsewhere, it may be a variant of that original tumor. Probably is, because the sensitive stuff dies. It doesn't spawn back. But the things that already probably existed to be able to escape or they adapt are going to be different, much like this COVID variant concept where it's like some are bad COVIDs and good COVIDs and they're still COVIDs, but they're different. Tumors evolve as well. And for whatever reason, I don't know that in the community practice that everyone kind of appreciates that concept. Otherwise, we'd probably be biopsying more often. Otherwise, re-biopsying really to see what is the new colony. So with all of that said, I have a very innovative team at Shepherd Health to help us understand and really appreciate the whole concept behind precision and tailored therapies that don't have to do with your kind of gross cancer type, but really what your cancer looks like. We have David Heisong and Catherine Arline from Shepherd, very aptly named, which I'm going to make you stay until the end of the episode to hear why, but it's to do exactly that. David and Catherine, thank you for being here.
Yeah, absolutely. Sanjay, thank you so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here, joined by my co-founder, Kate. As you said, my story was anything but linear. Did not expect to be on this podcast with you or doing this work. I'd done a number of different things, focused on anti-human trafficking work and had a military aspiration. And long story short, ended up at Harvard for the first of a couple degrees there when I was diagnosed. Right, so my story started in diagnosis with adenoid cystic carcinoma, a rare head and neck malignancy. No approved targeted therapies, no effective chemotherapies, you know, really kind of indicative of what so many pediatric rare patients face every single day, metastatic patients. So I decided to dive in, know my enemy, and Shepherd was born 8 months after my diagnosis. And then I had the great fortune to meet Kate in the Harvard Innovation Lab, who was running her own company. And through her story, which I'll let her share, convinced her to pivot, come and build this with me. And so the two of us have been together from the beginning. So thank you for having us.
Thank you. So actually, I convinced him to hire me, which I still don't know how I did that, but that was my biggest accomplishment. And my background was also non-traditional. So I started in development, design, writing, all kinds of things. And I came to Harvard Extension to do a degree in quantitative analysis and economics. I started a startup there. Out of the blue, one day, my fiance had a seizure, on a tonic seizure. I was diagnosed at 36 with oligodendroglioma, which is a very rare brain cancer, obviously. Fortunately, it does have a better prognosis than many. And he received very, very good treatment at MGH and is doing very well. But immediately I had questions, and they are pertinent to what you were saying in the beginning, because he had germline mutations and he didn't look like other patients. You know, he didn't share all the characteristics. And my questions without a biology background were, how is that going to affect his treatment and his outcomes? And that question persisted. And so when I met David about a month later, I said, I'd like to come work on this with you. And from that start, we really began to take a different approach to this, a big data approach. And that was more my background, to start by being hypothesis agnostic and not assuming that we know everything about a drug or a patient or cancer. And it allowed us to look at different data types like RNA and allow the data to be interrogated with algorithms and answer questions that we didn't know to ask.
That's incredible. And needless to say, both very humble, because it's apparently an argument on who grabbed who, but clearly that demonstrates appreciation. And I guess that's what really fascinated me about this. It's that we kind of, you almost get stuck piggybacking a nomenclature, at least in medicine, especially oncology, or guidelines, right? First, you have to see that the survival benefit's there. So it's, you know, usually years, and then that gets the approval. And then now you will have that approval that allows that, you know, therapy after the years of analysis, and then it's fixed in a way that preceded molecular therapy and all these kind of really unique, really, you know, honed in on understandings of cells, both the cancer cells and our cells. So I hope that quick outline, that quick layout can help one appreciate why things have this inertial kind of speed that's really hard to deflect from. And you all are doing that. You said we appreciate everything that's happening, but in our personal experiences, we know, being Harvard Ivy League people with more degrees than a thermometer between both of you, to say there is a litany of things out there that take into the considerations what medications are you on, right? If somebody's on 7 medications, metformin, statin, this and the other, and if their cells in their body, which include their cancer cells, have been exposed to, you know, an A1C of 10, meaning like super high sugars, versus somebody that didn't, versus someone that's a runner, all of these things cause variability in the patient's cells, the patient's response to drugs, either that are anti-cancer or just even normal drugs. And they're out there. That's the age of data. That's what we have. That's what X-Cures is also trying to accomplish with the same purpose. And you all said, so let's take those into consideration, because we know what happened to people that looked similar. I used to say, you know, if I have an Indian diet and I'm Indian and have a metformin, I'd really want to know what happened to the other Indian guy that also was on metformin and Indian diet in the 30s, right? And because there's a relevance there that you don't have to be medical to appreciate. And you all said, yes, let's look at all of it and see what the outcomes were. What were the features and little idiosyncrasies of hair color that were different between the cancer types within that named cancer designation, adenoid cystic, you know, or glioma? There are so many more things we've discovered that really are part of those first, second, third, you know, lines of therapy. And y'all are unpacking that and making recommendations, not just on which therapies show evidence that are the classic traditional anti-cancer, but also, I'm told, even the collateral medications that may influence the potency of the kill of some of those things. Tell us, if you can, unless, you know, about that and how rewarding that must be.
Yeah, absolutely. Kate, let me give the quick intro and I'll let the pass over to you. So Sanjay, as we discussed before the show, again, we consider ourselves that Shepherd lives in an indication agnostic world. We don't care about the nomenclature. We don't care what your cancer is called. Again, we're so operating in a world that uses nomenclature that's decades old and decades old understanding. We're still operating across hundreds of diseases that don't have NCCN treatment guidelines, or where those guidelines, again, are decades old. So from our standpoint, you know, it's an indication agnostic world. All of those factors that you just mentioned are reflected in our genomic makeup, in the multi-omic data that informs our treatment. So Kate and the team made a very early bet on leveraging raw transcriptomic data, right? DNA in action, robust data sources, and leveraging that in its raw form. So not limited panels, not specific targets, really taking, again, this agnostic approach and allowing each model or patient to be represented by that full picture, and then starting to understand a drug's activity across that entire spectrum, not just in the initial tissue or indication of interest, but to really understand all of the factors that might go into making the therapeutic successful or not to account for that variability. And I'd love to pass it over to Kate to say a little bit more about how the platform works.
Yeah, and that's a great characterization. I think from our standpoint, every single patient is a unique cancer. And so they come in with a diagnosis, but they, as you were saying, they have different backgrounds, they have different diets, they have different ancillary therapies that they're on to manage symptoms. They have different medications they're on to manage completely different diseases. The supplements they take, the nutraceuticals that they start with their diagnosis, they were taking before, all of that can help nudge the transcriptome in a specific direction. And so it's really important to meet that patient where she is. And that occurs from the moment of diagnosis all the way through. No matter how many times the cancer recurs, it changes every single day in every moment. And bulk RNA sequencing gives us a lot of power, a lot of insight into that, because it's a single time point and that's limited. But that single time point is a rich source of interconnections. Interconnections that tell you about how the tumor is metabolizing, its probability for metastasis, and how it's going to respond to drugs. It also tells us something about the health of the patient, because some new normal tissue is in that sample. So you can deconvolute it and look at it. We had a patient recently with prostate cancer, and we identified that his diabetes pathways were upregulated. So we asked him about that, and it turns out his blood glucose actually has been high for a number of years. And that can be taken into account in terms of what that cancer is relying on and which therapies might act on it and influence it in a positive direction.
That's incredible. Did I hear you say that you can appreciate when normal cells are starting to repopulate an area of the body that may have been, you know, monopolized by the cancer tumor?
Not quite yet, although that's a bigger picture thing we'd like to get to, because I'm very big on game theory approaches. And not just you going after all of these things with a slash and burn, you know, and trying to take them all at once, because you're really selecting for the very aggressive cells that may have been kept in check by the less aggressive cells. But we can start to understand the patterns of those cells as a single cell is used more for patients. Because one day what we'd like to do is not give you a drug recommendation based on all of your RNA, bulk RNA. We'd like to give it to you based on the individual cells in your tumor, let's say glioblastoma, which has lots of different heterogeneity, predict drugs for every single cell type, and then predict the order in which they're delivered. So we're working on that. We're not there yet, but big picture, that is the goal.
So I want to say it again in a way that kind of ties in what I've said on previous podcasts, in a way that I just was saying one day, or I hope, or why not? And this is the podcast where I'm saying that is exactly what you're saying when you say agnostic approach. I kind of recount this story of when I was early in fellowship, and one of the professors blew my mind because I was learning it the traditional way, cancer, cancer treatments. And he said, well, Sanjay, you know, one day we're not going to really gripe about if it's adenocarcinoma or if it's squamous carcinoma and the origin that we're obsessed with. And I was like, what do you mean? That's what all of our treatment guidelines are based on. And he was like, it's going to be so much more identified than that. Yeah. You cannot make an assessment of what I'm going to be like because I live in North America. There's Canadians and then there's, you know, American and North Americans. Can't even make the assessment just because I'm in Louisiana. That's what we're doing. And I've always said that on the podcast. We're just saying you're in that neighborhood and I have an idea of what you're going to behave like. However, I'm also aware that I have these very wide ranges of response rates that is still, you know, in 2024, very variable. It's like 20%, 40%, 60%. You would, and if you ever sat in a room, you might say, how do you not have a better shot? Like, how is this the best shot, you know, at the first go? And the reason, in part of several reasons, is also what we said before, is you don't know if that cancer type within that colony or that neighborhood, you don't know if it has a proclivity or desire to kind of hitchhikes early, like lift up their thumb when patients say, well, it's not that big, so that's good, right? I'm like, well, but you still have many lymph nodes. I mean, that means that the pathway of ensuring growth for that cancer is to hitchhike. So it might not be in one place. And on the flip side, sometimes I say, aren't I really, you know, in trouble because my tumor is so big? And I'm like, well, on the other side, I'm like, it's gotten this big. And it was this, you know, a year or two ago, and still you don't have any visible lymph nodes around. So I'm like, that growth, you know, pattern that cancer is doing is probably just grow, grow, grow. And so in a weird way, that might be favorable. So that's two of, I don't know, a gazillion different ways that cancers behave and have these like preferences. Some people want, you know, salt and nut and all of these things. I mean, there's so many metaphors you can use. And you all said, people deserve to have all of these variables considered. Yeah. Do they like salty? Do they not? Do they want to recruit blood vessels? Do they not? What are some meds that probably is making their recruitment of blood vessels easier for them? Those are the things you're assessing. And that's what you mean by agnostic,
yeah,
which is exactly what my staff said 10 years ago. We are going to identify some, you know, a person by every feature about them and less about what these guidelines almost force you in. That's the biggest headache with insurance companies is, well, it's, you didn't say it's a head and neck. I'm like, you don't understand. When you understand the biology, it's because X, Y, Z, and they don't care. And you all know that, have been knowing it, and you provide the literature support, like almost this like overwhelmment of saying, this is why this is supported. This is what happened. This was our theory. And this is the case report that shows its efficacy. So you take off the work of a busy med onc, in addition to have a tailored approach to cancers that, quote unquote, aren't behaving like we wanted it to. Like, there's nothing more offensive. It's as if the patient did something wrong, but it's really because there's a gazillion idiosyncrasies we're not considering in our standard guidelines.
Yeah. And I love what you said about biopsying often, because what we ideally would be able to do, and we have done this for a few patients when it's been offered to them, but is to have data from multiple metastases. And then we can go and look for each, what drugs appear to be effective for each metastases, and then select combinations of drugs to be effective as much as possible. And it's also to us, you know, coming from this as patients as care and caregivers to hear the patient. And I think one of my most important jobs is to listen to the patient when they come to us and I say, what are your priorities? You know, and for some of them, it is, I want really low tox, or I want, you know, tell me about these nutraceuticals, tell me about the statins. And to take, obviously give them every drug that comes out and it looks effective, but hear what they want. And then for you as the oncologist, you know, the toxicities that they can and can't tolerate, to give you an array of options that could be combined or used as single agents to really treat that person as an individual.
Incredible.
No, I mean, Kate captured it. You know, Sajid, I think the second half of the equation, the thing that enables us to do that, you mentioned treating every patient like they're unique. And then also one understanding that every drug is also unique. So I think it's important that, you know, we distinguish between similar chemotherapies of the same class. We distinguish among drugs that are typically considered to be interchangeable. And we do that by understanding how that drug works, again, across as diverse of a set of input and training data as possible. So again, looking at a drug's activity across ideally hundreds of types of cancers represented by patients or by models, to then pull out what are the signature, you know, the genomic signatures present in these patients or in these models that your highest responders have in common, so that then we can look for the presence of those in the individual patient in question. And so the ability to understand a drug's activity across hundreds of types of cancer, all of the multitudinous ways in which a drug might be effective, and it might be that the circumstances leading to effective treatment in one patient are completely different from those in another, and completely independent of the target or biomarker of interest that was, you know, supposed to drive treatment to the drug in response to the drug. So that ability to understand all of the dimensions collapse in a single moment that vote yes or no, will this patient have a wonderful response? And then again, providing that in a list and providing multiple options to you, the treating oncologist, it really enables us to differentiate from others, and to again provide actionable therapeutic recommendations regardless of, you know, status, regardless of when a patient was diagnosed, and again, to do so in a way that treats every single drug as unique as every single patient.
Yeah.
And I need anyone listening as a patient and thinking to themselves, I want that precision therapy. And that's why we call it Target Cancer Podcast. We really want to talk about the targets and the thing that's precise to the person, right? Some people, I think, glamorize the word like, oh, precision therapy, precision oncology. But it is an accurate word. And that means that we want to really attack the features of the of your tumor, not just, you know, group you as an American or someone from Louisiana, but your tumor. And the first time we talked about this concept, it was a while ago, but it was with Travera's CEO at the time, Cliff Reed. And you basically, they're taking out tumors and they're putting in different test tubes and seeing what has a decrease in its mass afterward. And they're taking that decrease in mass to mean, you know, possible sensitivity to the drug. And he made it a very good point, which we know, but we forget. And he was like, Sanjay, the reason we add these different random agents that are targeted therapies, usually like oral, you know, what we call TKIs, tyrosine kinase inhibitors and EGFR stuff, all the things that we know attack a receptor. He said, the reason we put them in the test tubes is everyone knows that 1 to 3 or 4% of the time, when you just try a drug that you use in a different tumor type in a different setting, it works. For whatever reason, it works. And let me be clear. This is a fact. We know this in science. We've observed this. We know that things work that may confuse kind of a newcomer oncologist. Well, that's not indicating that, but it works. And the reason it works is because, going back to the concept that your cancer cell has the same toolbox that your normal cells have, and this toolbox are tools that some people build houses, you know, better than others. The reason a baker is making millions and on TV is not because they have anything necessarily fancier than what you have in your house as a baker, but it's like what you are able to do with it. And cancers go into this pattern of really, in a sinister way, using any tool by any means possible to grow. That's what cancer means, unregulated cell growth. And what you all did said, okay, we know there's data that shows these, you know, what seems like random combinations exist. And I've done those. X-Cure is actually powered regularly my patients similarly. They didn't consider anything that was additional or collateral that wasn't a traditional anti-neoplastic drug. But every now and then these combinations would work. And, you know, it would be tears of joy because there wasn't anything by standard of care and the guidelines. And that's what you all are doing. You're saying, let's look at everything where this quote unquote random, you don't believe in random is what it sounds like. You're like, let's stop calling it random and figure out and notice the patterns on where it's not random. And the only way you can do that is to continue to reassess the tools that cancer is using that maybe behave differently in one place than the other. I love that you're looking at different tumor types. I've always said that.
Yeah.
I will go do stereotactic radiation to a site that's growing and systemic therapy is taking control of everything else because clearly that site is different. And I don't want to retire the drug I'm using that's working everywhere else because it's different. And that's what you all are doing, not just on a macro level from each tumor type, but within the tumor itself. And you're offering this to patients at any stage, it sounds like, correct? What is that look like? What is that process? They come and they say, hey, I would like a kind of a more precision therapy, or a lot of times, like in small cell and some tumor types, you have like a 20 to 30% chance of the next line working. And you're picking between a bunch of things that per data has 20 to 30%. I could see where this is, especially well, young or old, doesn't matter. A human would say, I would like better chances. And to me, that's what it sounds like you're trying to offer someone. Don't be pigeonholed in your tumor type and your macro classification of decades ago. Let's see what works today and any history or report of what works in this particular tumor type.
Yeah. So in terms of process, a patient can come to us through the website and we'll have a simple onboarding and usually, you know, have some email back and forth just again to understand their needs or offer to chat with them for a few minutes. And then most patients come to us and they have had some type of sequencing conducted. And that's great because one of our early and ongoing battles is that every patient deserves sequencing. If people walk away from this, that's as patients, I want you to hear that. If you have loved ones in your family and friends, go get sequencing. Get your DNA sequenced, full DNA sequencing, full RNA sequencing, beyond Shepherd, you know, because what that is going to do is give you the insights into what is working, what is driving your cancer, what drugs are available to you in this moment that are FDA approved targeted therapies, and then also what drugs are going to come on the market in the next few years that you're going through this journey that may be applicable to you. Get it when you are newly diagnosed. Get it when you're metastatic. Don't accept no for an answer. I hope you agree with that, doctor. But beyond that, so most patients come to us and they have had that done. There are a lot of great companies out there that offer that, including Tempus and Boston Gene. So talk to your doctor about it. And then once that's done, you get a report from them and that data can be shared with us. And then we're going to run it through our platform. And our platform is importantly looking specifically at RNA. So we also bring in the DNA, both the variants of known and unknown significance, and we'll assess those. But we're matching specifically on RNA. And this gives us the ability to match therapies even in the absence of really important driver mutations that are not present in a lot of peds cancers, a lot of rare cancers. So we can come in with options. And typically there will be a selection of chemotherapeutic options as well as targeted therapies and then things like statins. They will go through a very rigorous process on our side, not just to match against an algorithm, but also to match at the protein level for you, to match based on literature and other bioinformatic evidence. So there's numerous checkpoints that we go through and checks to make sure that what we're putting out really looks like it has good evidence for you specifically.
Unreal. I'm so glad you said that about getting sequencing. So I've personally gone on a federal level with Alliance for Patient Access and then on a state level on just that. And I'm proud to say Louisiana is the first, if not second, state to just not allow insurance companies to not approve molecular, even if you can't get the RNA, DNA, both and comprehensive. At least you have to know what your options look like and what you're a candidate for. And if somebody has not done molecular, and it's a sad reality that if you're a person of color, Latino, African-American, whatever, the chances that you had the molecular are even less, like in a stage four setting. But in the community in America, there's still an embarrassingly high percentage, high being relative, of people that aren't getting it offered or done. So if there's one message, Kate, you nailed it. For yourself and your advocate, find out what you're even a candidate for and what your prognosis looks like only by doing the molecular. You can't find that out without it. So I'm really glad you said that.
Yeah, Sanjay, glad you said that as well. And so at Shepherd, we've long tried to take a view that it's our responsibility to help build the world that we want patients to live in 5 years from now. So again, we do have a separate arm that's a private foundation. We've been working very closely with Congress and with federal agencies for a number of years. So to your point, we do have a bill bipartisan in the House and the Senate, led by all four co-chairs of the Rare Disease Caucus, named in honor of the late son of one of our employees who lost his life battling rhabdomyosarcoma, didn't receive molecular diagnostics until the very end of his journey. I think on the 12th opinion that his family sought for him. So it's named in honor of him. It's called the Finn-Sawyer Act. And again, it mandates CMS coverage of sequencing. Right up front, right now, CMS will cover if a patient is metastatic or recurrent or for a few more common indications upon initial diagnosis. So the bill seeks to extend that and say, look, every patient across the country with every type of cancer should be getting this right up front from start to finish.
That's extraordinary. And it's so meaningful for the person, you know, I can imagine facing the cancer challenge just to even know what they're candidate for. But also, it takes care of, you know, all of our people, right? Our humans in the future, because that's the way that we can really do better. If anyone's listening and frustrated, or even has the opinion that I see a lot on social, it's like, you know, it's on purpose that it doesn't work that well, et cetera. It's not on purpose by any means, but some of that, it could definitely be done better. And I think that's what obviously inspired this for you all. It's like, we have the data and we have the information and we have the tools to actually do better today, like with the snap of the fingers, if the culture and thinking changed or was updated, basically. And you all are doing that. And I'm extremely humbled to hear this. Yeah, it's incredible.
And like you said, it's what paves the way for the medicines to be made 5-10 years from now. The genomic data captured today will also enable you to have better treatment options tomorrow. And it will also help us to build better medicines 1 year, 5 years, 10 years from now. So that is the data that will, again, inform all of drug development. So again, like you said, it's an exponential impact for a patient.
Yeah, I would say the same thing and just say we've done big reviews, huge amounts of review of why drugs are developed, the databases under them, which drugs are developed for which patients and why. And one of the most important things you can do as a patient for yourself is to get that sequence. And then take it to everybody who can analyze it for you. Go get all of the opinions, look at it. But then also, if you're comfortable, you put it in the repositories, share it with people. And that information is going to lead to drug developers making decisions to develop drugs for the targets in your cancer and for especially if you have a rare pediatric or unusual presentation of a cancer. It's really, really important information.
And you all are looking both at the tissue molecular sequencing that was ordered as well as the blood, or is it one or the other?
We can look at both. Obviously, we need the tumor tissue. And so that's typically what's run by any company. You can also get a paired normal sample. And that's going to tell you, are there any mutations in your normal tissue and all the cells of your body that may have led to the cancer? And so you're probably familiar with BRCA mutations. A lot of patients have heard of that or might have had it in their families. And there are other things like that, like FAP, that come from a molecular basis and that can lead you to understand what is your risk overall for cancer and can drive both your cancer that you currently have as well as ones that may occur in the future.
Interesting. Because, you know, a couple we've identified, like BRCA, we know the implications, there's some treatment implications. But one source of frustration for me is having to explain to a patient, because it's unfair to them, when it has, you know, ATM or TP53. There's so many ones that we know are bad players, especially like even in myeloma with, I think, SFB1, SBF, something along those lines. And I always say, well, we don't know, or we don't have it, like, we know it's bad, et cetera. That's one small example of what you all are doing. You're like, okay, we know you have it though. So let's see what everyone else has, because we know it puts you in a different prognosis or different kind of a set of expectations. Let's go ahead and query everything that has to do with that.
Yeah.
Let's see how what is relevant medications against cancer and collateral medications you take for other things with that. I mean, you have the capabilities of assessing these many undetermined significance or doesn't have therapeutic implications, which is just frustrating, I think, for a patient, because all they Google and they say, oh, it's bad. Now you can help assess to see what people with that same, you know, quality or modifier may be responding favorably to or unfavorably to. And you only know that because they went through it, right? You're able to, that's what you're analyzing. You're finally looking at all the things that make the tumor unique and give it all of its, you know, properties that are more, again, hair color, eye color, all these things we don't really consider with traditional recommendations.
Yeah, I can give a very definite example of that, which is when my partner was diagnosed, I asked for molecular diagnostics. And again, I didn't know anything about this at that time, but I knew enough to ask for that. And there was some question about whether he should get those at that point. This was 7-8 years ago now, so a little bit different environment, not entirely different, unfortunately. But one of the questions was, what if we find a mutation and there's no drug? You know, what if he has another? I said, well, you know, he's got an APC mutation already. He has brain cancer. How much worse is it going to be? And we did find that he actually had an ATM mutation that potentiates radiotherapy. And he had an extremely strong response to the radiotherapy. It was stronger than to the PCV chemo, which is standard of care for oligo. And so he had a great response to all of his treatments. But I would bet that part of it is from that mutation that is in every cell of his body that we wouldn't have known about otherwise. And down the road, you know, maybe that informs the choice of, are you going to go after it with another toxic therapy, or are you going to try a little bit more radiation again? And so this is also really important from the information gathering standpoint. I think one of the frustrations I know for researchers is that there isn't enough information about these germline mutations because it's not, you know, incentivized to find out what's going on with children and with people who may have disorders that you then can't treat with current drugs. And so there are probably many, many more mutations, not news to anybody, that can lead you down a path of cancer, many cancers in your lifetime that just haven't been studied and documented. So would also encourage people whenever possible to get that paired normal sample as well.
I love what you just suggested. And I'm, I think, a little less hidden about it. And that's that you accepting, and social media in a weird way helped me, you know, with this concept, because it's very radical opinions, but I feel like there's a seed of truth to most everything that you hear, even if it's, you know, been radicalized. But the reality is there are things that do and don't happen because of you know, at the end of the day, in a for-profit system, for the most part, like, it's just going to happen or not. Like, and that is a reality when it comes to nutrition and vitamins and supplements. There's some truth to the fact that stuff's not investigated, which is why the doctor says, well, we can't speak on it because there's no data. Why isn't there data? That's the next question. And that's where, you know, I love what you said and respect that very much. And to the same point, well, to a tangential point, if somebody tells you, well, we can't get sequencing because you didn't have enough tissue and the biopsy's too hard to reach, your point being, you can still identify properties. Obviously, we know this with liquid biopsy, if you've listened to an episode before, because there you're capturing the shedding, the hair, the skin cells, the same thing that constitutes dust of good cells that shed. The shedding also occurs in cancer cells. So when you're grabbing that from a liquid biopsy, you're able to see what you call germline, meaning you have these things that are kind of bad players that let something grow unregulated that you were born with. But then you also have what's called somatic, which is the actual properties of the cancer. And then that's why I don't want somebody to get a quick door, you know, put in front of them when they hear this, because there are definitely ways to be able to still accomplish that.
And it's also just like knowing you have something, like you're a carrier for the Alzheimer's gene, and maybe that needs you to make lifestyle changes, you know, more exercise, different nutrition, different supplements. There are things that you can do to affect your health right now and affect the health for 20 and 30 years and reduce your risk of having these cancers. And so it's a personal decision. You know, not everybody wants to know that, but obviously we feel like more information is better.
Yeah. David, you had mentioned the word and multinomics, and I didn't peg the CMO of Grail when we had them, because they'd mentioned that too. There's this big excitement about it. How would you define that to help orient an individual to understand or appreciate what value that brings compared to the standard nomenclature, the standard kind of algorithms on how we recommend treatments today?
Yeah, sure. And I think it really just ties together everything you and Kate were speaking about, which is, you know, multi-omic information. Everyone's heard of the genome or genomic information. Most people are familiar with DNA. Won't be surprised if a number of listeners out there have never heard of RNA or the proteome or these other kind of factors that we were talking about. So multiomics, again, is the integrated study of all of that. As Kate mentioned, we really focus on RNA. It's DNA in action, right? You're looking at transcription. You're looking at those DNA letters, writing sentences, creating paragraphs, creating stories, put into work. Also, the opportunity to go back and look at DNA level information, as well as, I think Kate mentioned, when we look at a patient and we provide a recommendation on a patient report, we're looking at the protein level connections presence as well. So I think that the integrated study of all that information, one is a step beyond the DNA and genomic, you know, information that most people will be familiar with. And as you said, it's just an entirely different way of understanding disease. Each of us is a universe unto ourselves. We have that level of complexity, that many dimensions at work on a biological level. And so I think at Shepherd, we really try to move towards understanding the human body in that way. Every single cell has that multiomic information. Every single disease cell has that. So understanding that really allows us to recognize and achieve this vision of a truly personalized medicine world. You cannot achieve personalized medicine without a multiomic understanding of patients and of disease. That is the DNA of life, so to speak. The DNA of disease. And so it's only by recognizing that level of complexity that we're able to truly make that promise a reality.
Yeah. And I used an example once, and I have to disclaim as a metaphor that it's not to be insensitive about a very serious topic. And if y'all have a metaphor for me that's better than this, please do share. But one way I had described it previously in a certain setting was, it's as if you're getting a meal and somebody's recommending, I recommend the fish, the chicken, or the veggie dish, or saying, like, would you want the fish, the meat, or the veggie, right? That in itself is very nonspecific. You don't know if something's going to be appetizing just on the fact that there was the chicken dish, the fish dish, and the veggie dish. It's very poor accuracy or incompleteness when it comes to actual, like, efficacy for that person, you know, finding the meal favorable, for example. But it gives you an idea, because if you don't like chicken, you probably don't want the chicken regardless. But what matters is, you know, what kind of fish? Are there capers? Is it lemon, you know, sauce? Or is it hollandaise? These are all the things that make a difference in the success of somebody finding that palatable or enjoyable or wanting that meal again. And there's a huge variability. In a weird way to me, and now it makes sense in my brain, is cancer therapy is like that as well. We're like, okay, this is the chicken, this is red meat, and this is the fish. But the truth of the matter is, some people find it successful and find success with that therapy, and some people do not. And that there's a bunch of known. That's what I want to drive home to anyone listening. We know the variabilities that are out there. We know that sauce type of the lemon or not, or seared or fried or whatever. Again, not to take away from the seriousness, but as an example, it's all out there. And you can find out, I'll take it a step further. We had Dr. Henry Barham that isolated how you can assess your taste in a very objective way with T2R receptors and what it has to do with the immune system. Now, and he thinks it's crazy, no, everybody doesn't assess it when it comes to like in the wine and dining industry, because that is a valuable metric. The same way, it's all of that combined. That's what precision therapy you're doing. You're saying like, I'm done with that analogy now. But what you're saying is having all of those things that would increase the chance of success when it relates to the therapy and the constellation, the ingredients, all of them, right? That's why like people say, I used to say, there'll never be a cure for cancer, but there may be cures for cancer. And, you know, more than that, they're going to be little, here I am again, menus of the constellations of things and the sequence of those things. That's what Siddhartha Mukherjee made a good point. Emperor Balmality's Pulitzer Prize winner. He was like, it's not just the combinations, but it's also the sequencing and timing of the combinations. That's what you all are seeking.
Yeah.
And you know that somebody may need 4 out of 5 things, but they might actually not need that dual immune therapy because the immune system is not actually being blocked that much. Even though everything else is the same pancreatic, same sequence of the platinum sensitivity or whatever, you're trying to appreciate idiosyncrasies to that degree.
Absolutely.
Not trying, yeah. You are.
Yeah.
And that's what this provides. And I'll be honest, you know, this is not anyone listening, it's not a marketing thing, a payment here. This is just the whole point of this podcast is to share things that are considered the future, but really happening today. With that disclaimer, I'm very eager to try this because especially like some of my younger patients that have been really, very fit, there just aren't a lot of good options out there. And I end up having to send, I have one, actually one of my favorite patients, like stage 4 all over 3-4 years ago. She's a low income individual and I've been taking care of her for years and her performance status is still good. I have to send her to MD Anderson because a lot of their studies, they had the most studies applicable to her based on her sequencing that we don't have here. And now we're stuck. And I shouldn't say this on air, but I'm going to find a way to help her get that hotel and to help her get the travel because she is a very low income, but she has a good performance status and we've done all standalone therapies. Like this, you know, being completely transparent is where I'm very eager to see one way to spare her financial headache, right? Because it's already set her back from not being able to work with the therapies, but two, get that assessment. And I had to pick between the best of somewhat reasonable options to drive to. Whereas you are looking at all institutions everywhere and not institutions, I mean, that's actually what you're doing. You're looking at any evidence and literature, and then you can at least help the support for that combination in a setting where we have policy in this state that says, hey, if this is found to work in another drug type in a stage 4 and it's, you know, the last line, there's nothing else approved, we allow on a state level policy to try that therapy, like EGFR directed or whatever. That's what you're also trying to supply. To be able to get the insurance part taken care of it. And I'm very noble.
And one of the things I want to point out is that just as every patient is unique in the way you're describing, every drug is as well. So drugs that are against the same target, developed for the same cancers, they work in slightly different ways. They have different binding affinities. They have different things they hit off target. And even things like chemotherapies that are in the same class, like platinum-based therapies, we pull out different patients for each of those. And that can, you know, if you're talking about financial considerations, reducing the cost of trying the wrong therapy in one class or reducing all the burdens.
Toxicity.
Yep.
Yeah.
Picking the right class of drug, but picking the wrong drug in the class and getting a false negative in terms of the impact, potential impact of that drug for the patient is huge. And that's a lot of our work actually is identifying what are the really important mechanisms for this specific patient and which drug in that class looks absolutely the best and ideally why.
So that's been a lot of our work. And actually, let me pause and say, read your story about the patient you just mentioned. Let me just give a plug for a wonderful organization that we've worked with in the past called Family Reach, to any patients out there listening, specifically focused on providing financial support to patients when they're going through this journey. Again, wonderful, wonderful group of people, wonderful team. So just want to put that out there for patients listening. And then again, a lot of our work over the past 3 years has been working precisely on these patients. We've been sitting on a national tumor board as part of a national consortium of hospitals that specifically deal with refractory end-of-life patients that have exhausted standards of care and all other options. And then we're able to sequence them, provide therapeutic recommendations. And again, I've had some unbelievable responses. I've had patients that had failed 12 therapeutics, were intubated in the ICU, and who had been told that they should go on hospice 3 separate times. You know, fly home 2 weeks later. We've had patients that had CNS mets, you know, all over their spine, completely stabilized for a full year just off of a monotherapy recommendation. You know, we've had some really, really remarkable responses. And so it's just been so encouraging for us to say this is possible with the medicines on the market today. There's so much exciting, you know, technology and medicines coming down the pipeline in the next few years, next decade. But right now, from our standpoint at Shepherd, there is a drug combination to dramatically help, potentially save the life of, but dramatically impact the lives of every single cancer patient out there, regardless of their status, regardless of what stage they are. So it's been really rewarding work for us to see this play out in those situations. And again, would love to work with, you know, your patients, any others that are looking for options when there are none, for hope when they've been told that there's nothing left that their care team can do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the hardest things, people always say, well, how are you an oncologist? Isn't it hard, emotional, et cetera? I'm like, you know, yes, but the way you think about it is try to make them have not just the best chance, but also the best headspace and available, the confidence. You know, part of it is the journey, right? Because we all have a finite time. But I will flip it and say being, you know, visible on social media and all this stuff, that part is really hard for me because I end up getting obviously hundreds of emails, hundreds a week of very sad stories and please do something, right? And a lot of those, sometimes I would have done it differently or I would have said, you know, maybe this needs to be done, that needs to be done. And then those hurt me because like even more because it's like maybe there was some gaps in care. We know that it is not standardized to have the exact right pathway. It's not if you're community, academic, who the person is, it's just a fact. So that's hard for me, number one. And number two, an important point is people need to appreciate that another tragedy of oncology is when something would have worked or worked well. So in those emails where I'm like, well, really, why didn't they start with this one? Because the data from last month shows that this is, you know, usually pretty sensitive to this therapy. What happens is you have an option and you can't tolerate it. And that is where it really hurts as an oncologist, my wife and I, because the bone marrow just can't tolerate it. So you talked about 12 lines, but I could see a utility where instead of having where insurance and some guidelines mandate a 40% chance of success has to be tried in the second line, you have now deconditioned yourself, of course, but even your bone marrow and the potential toxicities you can expect with anything, because it's like being later in a boxing, you know, 12 rounds. Like at round 9, it's gonna be harder to take a punch and may not be able to get to round 12 because of the sequence of things that ended up, you know, having not even a great chance of working. And that causes me a lot of IBS and distress as well. And I can see how, you know, to help guide, and in a weird way, that's what the Trevera that always stuck with me. And like, it's why not have an adjunct to be able to hopefully help? Because a lot of the things that you're talking about on escape mechanisms, and I would love if you have a second, Kate, to talk about in a little more nerdy way, something we haven't really discussed, which is how the treatments themselves work differently on the person and the tumor. I assume it's both. Like, I want to hear more about that because now that's a whole nother mind-blowing part of the, you know, downstream frustration about why we have to give these kind of poor or very volatile ranges of success. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I think a very general answer, like let's take a TKI or let's take an HDAC inhibitor, and they're all hitting lots of different things. And you can have different mechanisms that work documented in different cancers and in different cancers with different mutations. So how do you knit all that together and how do you wade through that as an oncologist? You're describing, you know, how do you make decisions or was there a gap in care somewhere? And I can only say how my heart goes out to people having to make those decisions, because I can't imagine the burden of the volume of information you're supposed to take in, retain, you know, and extend and stay on top of it all the time. And so I think one of the strengths of the way our algorithm works is because of the way it's trained and the fact it's trained on things, tumor agnostics, and we're looking for lots of different tissue types, lots of different cell types, that you can identify the characteristics that are most needed to make it work, regardless of the specific regulation of individual targets of that therapy. And so that means that because you're matching all of those, we can have the algorithm say yes for all three of us on this call, but for slightly different reasons. And that would be visible in your transcriptome. And then that would be visible in the way at the protein level, the genes that are pulled out by the algorithm match onto your dysregulations, both at the DNA and the RNA level. That's a very general answer. I'll think if I can give you something much more specific, but that's it. You're basically measuring everything simultaneously instead of one by one by one. And in drug development, you know, a lot of the times you're trying to measure the
on. It's one by one.
Yeah, one by one. And that's the scientific method. And so what this really is, to be a little bit controversial, is to say, let's take a data science, let's take a data discovery approach to this instead of pursuing the one by one and seeing what changes. Because when you touch one thing, you're changing everything. And so the bulk RNA gives you that single moment in time where everything is measured. And then the algorithm, the data that it's fed, measure all those same things simultaneously as well. And then you're looking for a lock and key that matches up. And it's different for everyone.
I need to say that again, like, so people can appreciate. A lot of times, if you know someone that's been on that third or fourth line, they'll have like one or two agents or a pill that we would try this or, you know, whatever else. But that's because we first come out with the one thing, which, by the way, is never considered on what other medications you're on, the classic drugs.
Yep.
And then we, you know, we'll say, okay, maybe it's safe to add bevacizumab, or maybe it's safe to add immune therapy. And we do a study like that in combination.
Right.
What you're doing is all of that in real time. You're querying that and say, yes, you know, keep doing that. But instead of waiting a year or two or three to say it wasn't more toxic and whatever, yep. Again, you're not trying to replace it overnight and say it should all be gone. But you're saying, what about the people of today that, like, they don't have the study to see if that combination is not only is safe and less toxicity, but actually more efficacious. What about the people of today? Well, let's look at what we know and let's query it all and see if there's, like, you know, some database, science-based merit to that combination until, you know, waiting for these things that are,
yeah.
I think for a lot of doctors, frustrating. I mean, the number of times I used to have, now I'm just a pit bull, the conversation, we're just waiting for it out, the trials look good, but when it's approved, like, I'm like, that's ridiculous. Like, if it's like, this person's dying, you know, like, yeah. And progressing, and it's so frustrating, those kind of things that are just sad, kind of heavy sighs of healthcare system. And
yep.
I'm so excited and blown away that the thing I've been kind of complaining about over, I think, 50 episodes now, a lot of them are somehow in this, what we like to call a gumbo in the South, throwing all of it together, all the other problems and things that we're, you know, griping about. And you're like, let's find a way to make this happen and let's get the policy to change and adapt.
Well, one of the challenges of this work, I think, from your side is how do you use agents together that aren't really well studied? And so from our side, what we've done is curate 650 known oncology protocols, and these will have dosing information there. So if you look them up, you know, you're going to find what they were used in and how they were dosed and everything else. And that can be clinical trial data or standards of care. And it doesn't happen for every patient. They were able to match those. And it certainly isn't the case that those combinations have necessarily been used in your disease, but at least you risk the use of these drugs, right?
Yeah, there's something. Because there was one company that we interviewed also where they take fruit flies and they clone those fruit flies in populations and expose them to multiple combinations. But then my concern was, well, I can't use, you know, the fruit fly example to justify this combination to insurance, but I can use obviously data or literature or anything that's been defined, but nonetheless, very important work. I don't mean anything by that fruit fly example. It's so novel. It's like you're recreating the tumor and some of the circumstances of, you know, having organs and all, but all of these things are necessary. This is extraordinary. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Are you able to assess, like, if somebody's going to get bad neuropathy more than usual or bad diarrhea more than usual by looking at some of the polymorphisms?
We don't have that in there yet. And that's something, obviously, we'd love to work toward, and also integrating more information about the therapies they're already on and the side effects that are predicted there and predictions of toxicity. That's not part of it right now. You're talking about the ordering of therapies, and I do want to add, there's a little bit of really exciting data that we presented at AACR last year, which was showing that on clinical data sets, when we made drug predictions, we were able to take a clinical data set for patients who received all the same combinations of drugs. Half of them responded, let's say, and half didn't. And we found that if you predict on the pre-treatment data and the post-treatment data, that regardless of the response to that line of therapy, a new therapy was potentiated downstream for everyone. And so that's an avenue that we're very excited to pursue, because now you can start thinking about, from a clinical trial standpoint, your selection criteria can now include, regardless of response, what your pretreatment was, and know that that potentially potentiates the use of your next therapy. And so it opens up patients who may have been excluded from a traditional development basis, new therapies. And for us, it tells the story of, okay, if you dose with a drug, we know the transcriptome can change within 24 hours, that dosing can then pave the road for a new therapy work. And so you start thinking about how do you order therapies, how do you cycle through them. And again, from a game theory perspective, let's keep that tumor in check, not keep it from getting aggressive, and really intelligently design the route to a very good outcome.
That's incredible. Like, I need to illustrate that in a metaphor. I'm sure I lose someone every time I use my metaphors, and they die inside. But it helps me, you know, visualize. One, I was teaching my son chess, you know, like a week ago, and, you know, he's like, "Oh, I'm gonna kill, you know, take this piece." And I'm like, "Well, you know, Ashwin, you got to got to think about what's going to happen if you take that piece, right? Like that matters, like, because up front, it looks like it was effective. You got something off the board, but you lost this other thing. And that was a very simple concept for an 8-year-old, but that is a point as well. And what you're analyzing is we know sometimes how something pivots, like in, you know, in basketball, football, any sport, it's like, you know, when that's the point of the halftime is to say, this is what they're doing. They keep like going left, press them left. Now you're doing that. You know that they're going to adapt, but you also have to predict about what usually occurs when you change up your defense from man to zone, and now you know where the holes are. And again, I don't mean that to undermine the gravity, but take that and make it exponentially more complicated for a cancer. I mean, it's like it's all of that concept and intelligence put together, and it's doing it at a massive rate. It just wants to stick probability. It's not thinking. It says make every variation as possible, almost in an AI way, and just throw it all out. And that's why these things pivot. But a lot of them, because of selection pressure, have to pivot a certain way. And you're actually looking to see how that is at play as well.
Yeah, it'll take massive data sets to build that out and have a lot of predictive power around drugs. But I'm so excited to see, especially for Shepherd, you know, what the next 10 years hold, because I think we're going to be having a very different conversation about this platform in a year and 5 years and 10 years. And it's a huge vision that David and I have, and it's very, very exciting to be able to deliver this to patients.
I'm deeply humbled. I mean this. It's so evident that it's passion driven and that you immerse yourselves in it, like just completely saturated. It is life, and it's something that 99.9999% of people will never know, like, you know, came from you all. Either that concept of having that agnostic approach and having a diversified portfolio, or the policy, or what comes from the data to be able to make recommendations one day and be able to support it and change the way things are done. And obviously, I don't think for a second that either of y'all care about that. And I think that's, you know, very inspirational, and I'm very humbled, you know, for you both.
Thank you.
I do have one extra question though. Yep. Why Shepherd?
You know, Sundar, it's such a perfect name for what we try to do, right? We started focused on rare pediatric refractory cancer patients left out of development paradigms. We have a drug development initiative right now that we're spinning up focused on lower middle income countries throughout the world, starting in India, going beyond. You know, we were always focused on the least of these, and there are so many religious and political, you know, parallels that fit so perfectly, leaving the 99 to save the one, you know, setting out to be a champion to fight for those who cannot fight for themselves. It was completely unintentional. You know, we'll admit that on air, that it just came one day. I was looking at a big Marine friend of mine hold a puppy, and God help me, Shepherd came to mind, then it just clicked. So I wish that everything else was intentional. Maybe just say it was meant to be. But it captures what we set out to do very, very well. Sometimes these things just happen. So
I believe that the unintentions is the universe fulfilling purpose. I think the unintended is actually very intended, and it's to catalyze. It's almost a nod of approval that you're headed in the right direction. That's how I take it in my personal life anyway. So thank you both so much.
Thank you
for having us so much. Appreciate it.